Okay, we are in Esther, right?
I am.
Is that where we're at? Okay. Well, good, I studied that. We'll be okay. So, we're in the third chapter of Esther today, and we have... Who have we met so far in the book of Esther? Name to me who you've met so far in the book
Mordecai.
Of Esther. You've met Mordecai. Who's Mordecai?
Their uncle.
Of?
Esther.
Esther's uncle. He is what? What's his heritage?
Jewish.
He's Jewish. He's a Jewish man. Okay, so we met Mordecai.
Tribe of Benjamin.
Yes. Wonderful. Good remembrance. Okay. I can't even say that. And how can I mean himself? Xerxes or Ahasuerus, yeah. Okay, who is he? Who is this guy?
He's the king of... Sorry.
He would have been a Persian king.
He was a Persian king.
And he right now is ruling the kingdom, the multifaceted kingdoms of the Medo-Persian Empire. Okay, so... But he himself is a Persian. Who are the Persians today?
Iranians.
The Iran is Persian, which, by the way, is not Arab.
No.
Persians are not Arab. So, we'll do a little study on that someday. So, but that's anyway. So we have Xerxes or Ash, whatever, and we have Mordecai so far. Who else have we met?
Vashti.
Who's Vashti or Vashti?
Ex-queen.
She's the ex-queen.
She's the
you know at Christmas time they have that. Have you all seen that little elf on the shelf at Christmas time?
Yeah.
That's a little bit freaky to me. I don't know if that's it's kind of scary. It's a little elf on the shelf, the little guy dressed in red that they move around the house and do something with. I don't know what. It's a little thing for Christmas. Anyways, elf on the shelf. So now we have queen on the shelf. And that's Vashti. She has been put on a shelf for a while, right? All right, who else have we met?
Hegat.
Huh?
Hegat. Is that how you say it?
Hegai, who is what?
He's the
prince of the eunuch, okay? There's one other person you haven't even mentioned.
Esther.
Esther, thank you. We met Esther. There we go. So today we're going to meet someone else as we begin chapter 3 of this book. So we have another individual brought into the story. Again, remind you what's going on here. The kingdom that Ahasuerus, Xerxes is leading over is I get it's just not real stable, I guess I want to say. And part of that is the approach that the Medo-Persians did and would make it very difficult for it to be stable. But it's not only just the fact that you have all these outlying provinces that have people who have their own heritage and have their, you know, maybe against him. His problem comes from within. And apparently many times of plots to assassinate him. And last week when we finished chapter 2, you remember that there was a plot to assassinate Xerxes. And Mordecai, who Maxine shared with us, he heard about this, the plot, and he shared it with Esther. And then it was shared with Xerxes. And of course, Mordecai was given a lot of recognition and thanks and stuff like that. And that happened. And then, by the way, just what happens right after that is, you know, things go back to usual. So what happened to these two guys that were plotting against the king? They were, again, depending on your translation, some would say that they were hanged on the gallows. Others would say they were impaled on the poles. And it's the same type of thing. They were most historians would use the term impaled on the poles. Okay, that they actually would stick these long poles up, and they would put these guys on it, and they would die there.
And either way of dying, either on the poles or hanging, would be a public viewing, so that people
right.
would get a message.
Right. Right. Yeah, you don't do this. Yeah, and that was carried on to Jesus' time when you talk about the crucifixion. That's what the crucifixion's all about. That they would crucify them on crosses. They would do it in a public place, and it was part of that was a warning for them. So now we go into chapter 3, and we have a new person brought in to the story. It says after these things, and we don't know what that means. We do know it's after the assassination plot, but we don't know the time span here. So there has been a period, most people would say there has been a period of time between the end of chapter 2 and chapter, and almost a, what you would consider a significant period of time. Because it makes no sense that, you know, you would almost think if it happened immediately after, rather than Haman's name being there, you would think it would be Mordecai who would be raised up immediately. So time has passed. So here's what it says. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of... I don't know why they don't name these people right. Hamadatha? The Agite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. Well, what this also tells you is that this guy was neither a Mede or a Persian. He's another guy who's a part of the assimilation of the Medo-Persian Empire. But he didn't have the background either the Medes or the Persian. But he found favor in Xerxes' sight. And because he found it such favor, Xerxes gave him a great promotion. And you look at this. He set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So we talked about the 120 plus provinces and the princes that were in charge of each one of those provinces. And now we see Haman seems to be raised up above all of those people, so he would be the primary guy, according to what he says here, that would serve under Xerxes, which again would mean that Xerxes had great faith in Haman. Okay, because remember, what do we know about Xerxes? He's paranoid, and apparently not without cause, you know. But he's also very narcissistic. We talked about that. We talked about that. He's also very insecure. You know, everything's about him, and then you know, if it isn't about him every day, every minute of the day, something's wrong. You know, his world's falling apart. But also, there's the fear of those who would build an insurrection or raise a group that would overthrow him. So that was part of the worry. So we have Haman, who has found favor in his sight and raised up to that place. Now, if you were Jewish and you heard the name Haman, what would you have just done?
Boo.
He had a booed, yeah. And you'll hear the word in here later on. Purim is the Jewish festival that celebrates the God's rescue of the Jewish people from Haman. And as they do their little celebration, they tell this story. And when Mordecai's name is mentioned, they cheer. And when Haman's name is mentioned, they boo. And so they remind people of God's provision. So. Verse 2 says, and the king's servant who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. So the king had raised him up to such a place that when you saw Haman, you would treat him almost like, well, not almost, you would treat him like royalty. Which, look at what the king has done. This Haman is not of the king's family. Kind of makes you wonder what's going on in the king's family. He has nobody in his family he wants to raise up to this place, you know, and he has no brothers, he has no cousins, he has no sons or whatever like that to raise up this place. So we have this outsider that has found favor in the king's sight, has been raised up to a high position, and now by decree the king himself says, when Haman comes into your presence, you will treat him like royalty. Well, there's someone who has a problem with that. Mordecai has a problem with that. What is wrong with Mordecai? Why would he have such a problem to bow down in this way before Haman? Any thoughts? Maxine?
Well, because we're only supposed to bow down to God.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Haman is what we would call a completely Orthodox Jewish man. Mordecai, excuse me. I know I'll do that 100 times before this is over. So Mordecai is and it's something within him that he will give due honor to the king, just the way Daniel did and Ezekiel did and stuff. But to bow down almost in an act of worship. And that's what this is being described here. Not just to say, to give recognition for someone's position, but to bow down in the sense of worship. Mordecai cannot do that. In the same way that Daniel said, when they said, you'll pray to Darius, and Daniel said, Daniel couldn't pray to Darius. He could only pray to God. In the same way with Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they could not bow down to the image, remember? And so they were cast into the fire. Boy, I'll get this right. I'm good, I think. If I go down, someone rescue me, okay? So he could not do that. And this is, again, I want you to see the terminology here that you'll find as it's written by the author. It's more than just recognizing someone's authority. It is to the place of almost revering them in worship. And of course, Mordecai cannot do that. And by the way, neither should you. Everybody got that? Yeah, there's only one, there's only one we bow down to in worship. The Bible does teach us that we are to respect and honor those who are in positions, but there's a huge difference between respect and honor and praying for somebody and giving adoration in the way of worship. That's what Haman wanted. Haman, talk about getting heady, getting the big head. Haman, this is a great thing for him. He basically, by description, has no cause to hold this position, and he's a nobody who all of a sudden got everything. Okay? So, verse 3. Or verse 2, at the end, Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Verse 3, then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Why are you doing this? They were concerned about this. Verse 4, now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them that they told it to Haman. And to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. So when they asked him why, it's not, the full explanation is not here, but the end of verse 4 tells you what Mordecai told them. His faith in the one true and living God would not allow him to do what was required for Haman. Now, what you first of all notice here is Haman doesn't notice this at all. But others notice it. And what do others do when they notice it? Bunch of tattletales, aren't they? You know, they run in there and they tell on Mordecai. They've really got their nose in someone else's business. Okay? So, when they asked him, he told them, they went and told Haman, and it's almost like they're being used, well, not almost, they're being used of the enemy to try to attack Mordecai. And so, look at what it says what they do. They go and they tell Haman to see if Mordecai really, they're testing him, to see if Mordecai really believes what he says he believes. So in other words, Mordecai, if Haman, who has the authority to do so, commands you to do this, will you really still stand? I mean, it's kind of like this. It's easy for you to stand when nobody notices. Haman's not noticing you now, so it's easy for you to make that stand. But what about if we go tell Haman, and now he starts looking at you. Every time he comes in the gate, he's looking right in your direction. Okay? The world will always test us, folks. They'll test us without you even knowing it. Our biblical integrity requires that we do what's right because it's the right thing to do. Not because anybody's watching. Because you need to understand that they are watching. They are watching. Always we need to do what's right. Always. You just don't know. What people are looking at, what they're considering, what's going on and stuff. So when things happen in life as they happen in life, that which you say you believe, you need to live out before the world, because someone is always watching. They're always testing. You know. And by the way, we need to be careful that we don't throw a bunch of empty platitudes out there where we say we believe something, and then when the heat's turned up, then we pull back from that. Be very careful what you say before you say it, because the day is going to come when what you say is going to be tested. And the enemy of your soul wants you to fail. So I believe he will always, if he as he gets the opportunity, he will always bring a situation into our lives to find out if we really believe what we say we believe. It's the way he works. We need to be very careful to understand that our Christian faith is not a bunch of statements about what we believe. Our Christian faith is how we live out what we say we believe. And the strength of our Christian faith is not in word only, but as James reminds us and as John reminds us in 1 John, it's in how we what we do and how we live our lives. So words are never enough. Words are never enough. Action is always required. Action that validates what we say we believe. And I believe as time gets shorter, it's going to become more part of our everyday walk as Christians. You know, we've been pretty comfortable here in America, but I think it's going to become more and more where we can't just say something. It may start costing us something. Someone back here was going to say something. No? Okay. So, when you look at that, when you look at verse 4, I want you to see how the enemy works. And he hasn't changed his strategy because it works for him. Okay? So, again, make sure that your faith is more than just words. Make sure that your faith is the way that you live. And to me, that's what integrity is about. That doesn't mean we don't slip up at times. We all slip up. We all fail. We are imperfect. But that's why we need to be careful what we say. You know, and before we make declarations, we need to really mean what we say before we put it out there. So Haman has told them why he can't do this. Now they're going to test him and say, well, we'll see if you're still doing the same thing when we tell Haman about this. I mean, Mordecai said he wouldn't do this. I know I'm going to do this all the time. Mordecai said he wouldn't do this now. So they said, well, we'll see if you'll still do that when we tell Haman. Because you know that's how that works. Haman had no recognition of Mordecai's existence at all. But once someone puts a little bug in his ear, you know, all he can see now when he comes into the king's court, all he's going to see is that guy. It's funny. Think about it this way. Everybody else is bowing down to him and slobbering all over him and all this kind of stuff. And there's one guy that won't, and he can't see everybody else. All he can see is that one guy. We're like that too, aren't we? But you know, everybody likes us except for that one person, John. I'm just kidding.
It could be.
So we focus on that one person. We're that way. But John likes me, so you know, right, John? Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. So now look at verse 5. It said, when Haman saw Mordecai did not bow and pay homage to him, Haman was filled with wrath. Now look, Haman, that's what I just told you. All he can see is Mordecai now. Yeah. And the fact that this one guy will not do this, what's it do with the countenance of Haman? He's filled with wrath. You know, this term wrath here it speaks of uncontrollable anger. And this kind of wrath is a kind of wrath that can consume somebody where they can no longer see anything good or anything positive. And it doesn't matter if 99% of it is good, that 1% consumes them. And maybe you've met people like that, and maybe you've found yourself in that place at times in your walk and stuff. But, you know, through the years of ministry, I've met several people like that. Let me just say several people like that. And it doesn't matter when you sit down and try to talk to them. All they can focus on is that one thing. And sometimes you want to say, listen, don't let the one thing consume you. Because life is filled with one things. And I've met people that I'm convinced that they live for the one thing. They like things to be sort of, they live from one crisis to the next. And as long as there's a crisis, they're okay. But they can't see all the other good things. And that's what's happened here. Haman is so consumed because someone has put this in his ear that, hey, there's one guy There's one guy, he won't bow to you. He won't he'll give you due regard and stuff. And now all that Haman can see is Mordecai. Mm-hmm. And again, you would have to ask this question. Who's Mordecai at this point? He's a guy who gets to set in the king's gate. So he gets to set there, so he has a little bit of... But who is he? He's Mordecai. You know, so we read on, verse 6. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for he had told him of the people, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Wow. Talk about an acceleration or a blowing up.
He's really bad.
Talk about demonic influence, and I don't want you to miss this because I think this is exactly what this is. What would cause someone who had, you know, you're Scandinavian, right? Okay. I know she told me that before, so I wasn't guessing that. So suppose you made her mad, and her response with that is she's going to take out all Scandinavian people.
Oh,
Maxine's back and say, bring it on. But just think about how that somehow just blows up to, I mean, how do you get from this being mad at one person to expanding that to everybody?
Yeah.
If we're not careful, we do that sometimes too. We find the differences in one person that makes us mad, and we attribute that to everybody that reminds us of those purposes. We call that prejudice. That's how it works.
Hatfield, you know? McCoy's feud.
Huh?
The Hatfields and
the Hatfield and McCoys, and so, you know. So, yeah. I mean, the world is just filled with this kind of thing. Somebody of some group that we have put in a group, or and they've done something. So now all the people in that group, you know, are this or that and the other thing. Well, that's how the enemy works, and I don't want you to miss that. And he works this way over and over and over again, because he knows that it divides people. He knows it moves us to a place where we cannot have God's love and compassion for certain groups because someone in that group did something to us. Now, in this case, I want you to see how Satan once again has a plan. God has a plan, and God has always had a plan. That is that he would send his son. Long before Jesus ever came, long before even the tribe that Jesus would come out of, even before Abraham ever was, long before that, we have God giving his message to Eve, telling her that her seed would crush the head of the serpent. We move on through history as God has written it for us, and we see that God raised up a man from nowhere by the name of Abram. And he makes Abram a promise, a covenant promise. He carries that covenant promise after he changes Abram's name to Abraham. He carries that covenant promise to his son Isaac. From Isaac, he carries that covenant promise to his son Jacob. Later, he changed Jacob's name to Israel, and Israel becomes the father of the nation of Israel, has 12 sons. In those 12 sons, he has one son by the name of Judah. In the prophecy, he says, out of the tribe of Judah will come Shiloh, which is the king, which is the prince. Okay? From that tribe Judah, later on in our history, as God writes it, we have a man by the name of David, of the tribe of Judah, and God promises that the Messiah would come from not only from the tribe of Judah but from the house of David, and then time comes and God's perfect time, Jesus comes. We're in between the time of David and Jesus. That's where we are here. Okay? Do you not believe that Satan knows God's plan? Mm-hmm. By the way, he probably knows the Bible better than most of us. He knows God's plan. Okay? And don't you believe that he always is at work trying to destroy God's plan? Of course he cannot. But here we have recorded for us one of the first times where Satan, I believe, influences a man to try to destroy a whole people. to break up the plan that God has, to destroy God's plan. So God could not fulfill his covenant. I want you to think about this. You can carry that even to the place where Jesus and Matthew, and remember when Peter says to him, after Peter has this great confession of who Jesus is, and then after that, the next chapter, Peter says, when Jesus says, I'm going to go to the cross, and Peter says, oh Lord, I would never let that happen to you. That's not going to happen to you. We'll stop it from happening. And Jesus, who just said, blessed are you, Simon Peter, in the next chapter says, get behind me, Satan. And he was not addressing Peter, I don't think specifically, he was addressing Satan there and saying to him, you're not going to stop the plan of God. But here, back here in history before that happened, we have Satan attempting once again to stop the plan of God. And he incites this man Haman with such hatred for Mordecai the Jew that he said, it's not enough for me just to take care of Mordecai. That's what that, when you read that thing, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, but he disdained to lay hands on, his intent was to lay hands on Mordecai. It's not saying he's not going to lay hands. He said, in his mind he was saying, it's not enough. Killing Mordecai would not be enough for him. Let me destroy all the people of Mordecai. Let's destroy all the Jews in every province and every region. By the way, this province and region where the Jews were included what we call Israel. Because some would say, well, didn't some of the Jews already go back to Israel? And the answer would be yes, but they would still be considered a province under the headship of the Medo-Persian Empire. So when this decree that we're going to see goes out, it goes out to all the provinces, including Israel. The intent was to destroy the Jewish people from the face of the earth. Anywhere you found a Jewish person, they were to be destroyed. That's what he's going to say. So, again, I want you to see it. He said, you see the hatred and you see the evil that's in this man's heart. And you see, I hope you see the working of Satan here, because he says, it's not enough for me just to get him. I'm going to get anybody who's associated with him. Questions or comments on that? By the way, Satan tried to do that again. You know, I think about some of you were probably little children when that happened. You know, in the 40s, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some of your spouses served in the military and stuff that fought against that. When he raised up, I believe Satan raised up Hitler, and his thing was to destroy those people again, those dirty Jewish people.
Put them in the ghetto.
Yeah. Well, and then into the ovens and all that. Yeah. So this is what verse 6 describes what is happening here. It's not enough for him to get Mordecai. He wants to get every Jewish person because of Mordecai. Okay. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, and that month of Nisan would be attributed to who? Well, that's Nisan is not a Medo-Persian month. It is a Jewish month. So the reference here is a Jewish reference, the month. Okay, in the 12th year of King Ashurus, they cast Pur, that is the lot. Okay, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So he's making this decree. To what? To get all of the Jewish people. Well, how are they going to decide to do this? Well, that's where the word per is lot. So they would, it's like throwing dice. Or bones. I don't know what they were doing back then. Bones or dice or sticks or whatever. But it was some way to cast it to determine, you know, when they were going to do what they were going to do. And interesting that even when they cast lots, which they thought was by chance, I think you see the hand of God even in the result of the lots that are cast here. Didn't, you know, what would happen if it happened a month from then? God gave a whole year actually before anything could take place. Okay? So that's that Pur, and Purim speaks of that casting of lots. Okay? that Haman was doing to, again, to make a decree to destroy the Jewish people. Verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people." Oh, don't you love that? "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom." Now remember who he's saying this to. He's saying it to a paranoid, insecure narcissist. So does Haman know how to play the king? Of course he does. So how does he say, we're not, he's painting him a picture like there's a certain group of people that are against you. There's no evidence that the Jewish people were against the king. Now, of course, they could not, because of their faith, could not bow down and worship and do what the king said. But overall, listen, overall, the Medo-Persians allowed people to keep their religious and even their ethnic heritages, as long as they understood that they were kept underneath the rule of whoever the king was at that time. Prior to this, it wasn't a big deal that you had a group of Jewish people that worshiped the one true God, Yahweh. Because there were other groups there that worshiped multiple gods, you know, and you know, all the different groups just brought their religious heritages together. But Haman is going to use their faith to destroy them. Satan has not changed, folks. If you're going to be a follower of Christ, a disciple of Christ, you can know that the one place that the enemy is going to attack is at the place of your faith. And your faith, as the Bible says, will be tested to find out whether it is a true faith. So, he says, "There is a certain people scattered among and dispersed among the people in the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples. And they do not keep the king's laws," which is not really a... It's true, but not true, in the sense that the decrees to worship, like with Haman, they don't keep that. But other than that, they're not a people causing trouble. They're not a people disobeying the king's laws. They're, as far as anything we know, they were good citizens. They just could not worship anybody but God. "Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain." I mean, he's really just playing this up. King, you need to kill every one of them. Okay? Understand at this time, there's no other kingdom. Everybody got that? There's really no other kingdom. Now, it is true at this time that there's another kingdom that's rising. Anybody know that kingdom that's rising at this time? The Greeks. And we're about to have, the Greeks and the Medo-Persians are about to have some of the biggest battles that, you know, that we read about in history and stuff. The Greeks under the leadership of Alexander. Alexander's not on the scene yet. So the Greeks are just starting to, and the Greeks have said to the Medo-Persians, we're not gonna submit to you and stuff. Other than that, you need to understand that in the world at this time there's no other kingdom. The Medo-Persian kingdom was it. It was the world ruling power. So when Haman says to him, "It's not fit for you to let them remain," he's not saying you need to kick them out of the kingdom. He's saying you need to destroy them. There's no other place for them to go. And again, the Medo-Persians had this philosophy. You assimilate or you're destroyed. That was your two options. You bow to the king and you recognize him as your sovereign, or you're destroyed. That's the only two options. No one was just left to say, okay, well, we're going to be Switzerland in this. No, you can't be Switzerland in this. You have to be either with the king or you're destroyed. So, by the way, there was no Switzerland at that time. That was just an example. Everybody got that? So, he's using this, and he is the very least, he is using a lot of hyperbole here. At the very most, he's just flat out lying to the king. Xerxes has had no trouble with the Jews prior to this time that we know of. Not a bit. Matter of fact, we've seen that it was a Jewish man that protected the king from those who would try to assassinate him. So, of all, you know, you have to wonder how many others heard what these guys were plotting and didn't say anything. But it is the Jewish man, Mordecai, who actually is the one who honored the king. You know? So it's kind of, again, it coincides with, it reminds us of the story of Daniel, which happened previous to this, is that these people were trying to get Daniel where? At a place of faith. And they were saying to Darius, Daniel doesn't show you due regard or due respect. Okay? And Darius knew different, but he had got caught up in the hype. And he made a decree before he realized, before he thought out what all the things, what part of that decree would bring, particularly on Daniel. So here we have this same mode, the same thing happening. Now look at verse 9. If it pleased the king, let a decree. I love that. You talk about, you know, I don't know, you can use all kinds of term of smoozing the king. There's more rude terms, more, but that's what he's doing. If it pleased the king. I guarantee you, if you read that in literature or you read it in the scripture, those guys never said that until they were sure that what they were proposing was pleasing to the king. You understand what I'm saying? He knew how the wind was blowing. He knew this king, and he knew how to, and so now he's going to say this because he makes the king think this was your idea. Yeah. You're such a wise king. You're so, you know, you're so brilliant, and this was your idea. But it wasn't. Again, it's manipulation. He said, "Let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. Kind of interesting. I will pay them to bring into the king's treasuries. We don't know the number of Jews at this time, but we are talking, as he said, about these Jewish people were spread throughout all the provinces and stuff. This would be a massive undertaking. And think about it really would be a slaughter. Okay? Now, I want you to think about the amount of money that he's talking about here. I did a little breakdown for you here. At today's rates, I checked what silver was today. Okay? So, he says 10,000 talents. What's a talent? A talent is a measure of weight. And it was used to measure either gold or silver, whatever precious metal that you were talking about. A talent weighs about 75 pounds. Okay? So he said, I will give 10,000 talents. Think about the size of that of silver, okay? So, for the people in that day, the Jewish people, the closest reference is we had what the Jewish people were paid in the time of Jesus. And their daily rate was called a denarii. Okay? It would take a Jewish person 16 years of getting paid a denarii a day to make out one talent. 16 years. There are 6,000 denarii in one talent. So that lets you know about that. And a talent in today's rate, this morning's rate for silver, once it equals $16,756. Now you multiply that by 10,000, and what he's offering is $167,562,500. That's huge. That's a lot of money. Now, so you say, wait a minute. Mordecai's going to pay them. Excuse me, Haman is going to pay them. How was Haman going to pay them? Well, Haman was going to pay them out of the treasury. But notice what he says at the end of this. And this will be brought back into your treasury. Anybody ever heard of taxation?
Tell us.
Okay, so you've all heard of that. So what he is proposing to the king, I want you to get this picture. King, this is what we will pay them. And then we will turn around and we will receive back from them. And so you'll get two things done at one time. Okay? You'll eliminate these who are in opposition to you, but also you'll spend money, you'll put money right back into your coffers. And it's a huge amount of money. Maxine.
A couple of points.
besides Xerxes being very paranoid, he also didn't handle money too well. And so therefore he gave that authority in the hands of Haman and he trusted him.
Right. Yeah. Clearly Haman must have had the power of the treasury to make such a statement. Okay. And talk about voodoo economics. We're going to pay this out so you get it back. He's going to get less back than he paid back. Everybody got paid out. Everybody got that. But somehow, again, you know, what do they say? Numbers lie. Anyway, we'll move on. Sunday, let's start.
I think he was actually going to get the money back based on the fact that once all the Jews are gone, then you have all their belongings.
That's true too.
You have all their livestock.
You have everything.
Their jewelry.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Didn't even consider that, but that would be true. So he's paying these guys to do this, and plus the riches back. Yeah.
So they still don't know that Esther is Jewish at this point?
They don't know. And remember what Mordecai told her, don't tell anybody. So even Ahasuerus or Xerxes does not know his wife, his queen, his main queen, doesn't even know that she's a Jewess. Okay. Which again would tell you how much assimilation has happened under the Medo-Persian rule. Okay. People, these different groups have really kind of assimilated. I mean, it really is. The Medo-Persian Empire, as they have it set up by this time, is really, we think America is being the first great melting pot, but it isn't. Actually, this is one of the first great melting pots. Now, most of ours, we believe, is done
voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. Theirs was done by power, but over time, the melding in happens. Okay? So yeah, that's right. They don't know yet who she is. And Haman doesn't know who she is. Because, you know, knowing that, well, you'll see later on how he reacts when he finds
she
out.
Has a Persian name.
Huh?
Esther's a Persian name.
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah. Remember, Esther was presented as Esther, which is a Persian name, mm-hmm. and her name, we found out her name as we began.
Hadassah
is her Hebrew name. Okay. All right. So that's the plan. Haman has a plan. Verse 10. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman. What does that mean? It is exactly that. It is a transfer of ultimate power. With that signet ring, pretty much anything that Xerxes could decree, Haman could decree. Yeah, remember the story of the prodigal son, or the story of the loving father, whichever way you want to, or the story of the bitter older brother. You can put any name you want on that. But you remember when the son came back? What did the father do? He put a robe upon him, and then the next thing it says he did what? He put his ring upon his hand. And he said, "This is my son." When that once again represents that the authority of the father was put back upon the son. He wore his father's ring. And here, the signet ring is the ring of, you could say, it's the signet ring is a ring of decree. When the king would decree something, they would pour the hot wax there, and then they put the signet. That was a seal. Like today, we carry that on. We still have seals that we put on official documents, you know, including the ink seal that we do. We call that a notary seal. And it's supposed to validate whatever the document says. Okay? So, he gives him his signet ring from his hand. And notice how the scripture describes him. He again tells of his heritage. But then now it says this about him. The enemy of the Jews. Haman has a new meaning for life for him. It's the hatred of the Jewish people. Which starts how? By one guy that makes him mad. It's just really is. I go back to that because it really tells us, if we're not careful, how easily we can go down that road with things. Not everybody that you see, you know, when you see someone doing something, they may be of a certain group, does not mean everybody in that group does that. Yet we have a tendency to do that kind of generalizing and stuff. I could probably today put a picture of two Arab people on the wall up here, and looking at them, I wonder what would run through our minds. Two Arab people, two Arab men. Both with the head cover, with the hair and stuff like, and you look at them up there, you know, and I wonder what would initially run through our minds. And if we're honest, sometimes I think many of us would say, "Oh, Muslim, oh, terrorist, ISIS." I mean, let's just be honest; those things would run through our minds and stuff. But you know that there is a huge group of Arab Christians,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Brothers and sisters, that those people in ISIS are killing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yet we over here would look at them, we would put them in the same category. We just do that. It's easier for us. Sometimes it's easier for us to do that than to consider the preciousness of a single soul. And I think we have to be careful of that. We have to be careful. And I think we also have to know where that kind of thing comes from in our own country, in our own cities, and in a world situation. I think it's the enemy who wants to see God's people and God's creation destroyed. The men's breakfast had a few weeks ago a gentleman who come. He is from Afghanistan. Again, if you saw him, you might, the first thing run through your mind, what's that Arab doing here? What, you know, what's this, you know what he's doing? He's a Christian brother who lives in Atlanta, Georgia, who's reaching the people who are coming from that region with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm just saying we just have to be careful. It is the easiest place for us to fall back on. You know, it's the easiest place, and it's what prejudice is. And there's nothing godly about prejudice. It's contrary to even the heart of God. And we have to check ourselves and stuff. So when you look at how he describes Haman here, now he has become the enemy of the Jews in verse 11. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you. Do with them as seems good to you." So he's the whole thing. So now what do you have? You have a campaign that is driven by demonic hate in the hands of a man who has one goal, and that is to destroy a people. So we can't go any further than that this morning. Questions or comments before we close? There is a theme here that I think we need to hang on today. Mm-hmm. We don't want the enemy to get a foothold, and we really need to do our best to treat each person as an individual. Okay. Any other questions or comments?
One comment. I was thinking the men that went to